Good afternoon and welcome to the February meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you from Point Lookout on the coast of Maine. And a particularly warm welcome to our public radio audience. My name is Pat Mundy and I'm a board member of the forum and today's moderator. Since 1983, we're celebrating our 30th year. The forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert from the world of foreign service, journalism, or academia to talk about critical foreign policy issues facing the U.S. and answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about past and upcoming programs are available at our website, midcoastforum.org. Our speaker today is Dr. Michael Pillsbury. He is a consultant to the Department of Defense with a background and expertise on China. He speaks fluent Chinese. In 1975-76, while an analyst at the RAND Corporation, Dr. Pillsbury published articles in Foreign Policy magazine and International Security, recommending that the U.S. establish intelligence and military ties with China. The proposal, publicly commended by Ronald Reagan, Henry Kissinger, and James Schlesinger, later became U.S. policy during the administration of Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan's administrations. He is currently consulting, as I mentioned, for the Department of Defense. Let's give a warm welcome to Dr. Pillsbury.
Thank you very much. Public speaking isn't what it used to be. Before the prosecutions of leakers began, the Obama administration has distinguished itself. The media does not like this. For the maximum, the largest number of prosecutions of leakers in American history. There are now six prosecutions underway. One gentleman was a CIA officer for a long time. He's going to jail for 3.5 years. And these prosecutions are accompanied by a series of newspaper stories, one last week, that everybody with a security clearance who talks publicly, and that would be, of course, what I'm starting to do right now, can and will be investigated if they get into gray areas or begin to say things they shouldn't. And that the government now, that is to say the FBI, has an email program that can scan all your emails and pick out words that shouldn't be in there. In addition, after public appearances, sometimes you get a phone call. This happened to me. I went on CNN. I gave what I thought was a brilliant and charming interview to Lou Dobbs. He asked me a lot of questions. I had a piece of paper in my hand. It was about the prosecution of a Chinese accused espionage agent that lived in California named Chi Mak, and part of it concerned ships being built over in the Bath Ironworks, your shipyard here, and other things. And I thought it was very creative of me to say, you know, I really admire the FBI. They went through this suspect's trash out the back of his house and found handwritten notes he'd made about what his Chinese handlers wanted him to spy on. And he succeeded in the following 4 or 5 ways, and I listed the ways. Well, the FBI gentleman said, you know, you realize you know all about this case because you can read top secret American government information. Now the trial hasn't even begun, and you're talking about it on CNN. Do you have any idea the degree of trouble you're in? And then I sort of said, no, not really. And then they start out with this famous phrase, you have the right to remain silent. Now, fortunately, I had a lawyer there with me, former Secretary of the Air Force, as it happens. And I said, you know, that paper I had in my hand, that was the Department of Justice public memo on the theory of the case. And it had all the stories in it about going through his trash, how smart you FBI guys are, and all the other points I made. In fact, you can see on the videotape, I was holding the paper in my hand and reading from it. Oh, can we have that paper? When we gave it to them eventually, and the problem went away. But it has a lasting effect on people like me when this sort of thing happens. So, you'll never guess what I have in my hand here. A piece of paper. It's a brilliant speech by the Deputy Secretary of Defense, which remains the authoritative statement by the Obama administration about our current policy toward China and toward Asia. So I, at risk of disappointing you that I'm a boring speaker, I'm going to give you a few sentences from this speech so you will know the official policy, which, by the way, I not only support, but I advocated it back under the Bush administration. So I was quite happy when President Obama did this. Then I'm going to tell you a little bit of interesting stuff to justify my honorarium and being here about the Chinese reaction to this speech and to several other speeches that have been given by President Obama, Secretary Clinton, and others over the past year. Because the heart of the story, the heart of the speech is our government says, well, we are rebalancing our military forces and our diplomacy and our trade efforts toward Asia. And this is a good thing, we say. And then almost all of the speeches say, and by the way, this is not about China. And some of the speeches are even more extreme. This has nothing to do with the rise of China. And other more talented public spokesmen, quite high in the Obama administration, go even further. Anyone who thinks this is about China really doesn't understand our new policy. So I will give you the Chinese views. Susan and I went over in June most recently to hear all this. And the tragedy for us personally is that a lot of media leaks have come out, not from me, saying that the office I work for in the Pentagon is the source of this new rebalancing strategy. And that my own published articles over the past 12 years, two books I wrote 10 years ago, all laid the foundation. So you can imagine Susan and my reception when we reached Beijing. They think they're talking to the satanic figure who created the strategy. And also, they said, you told the Obama administration to deny this is about China, but you should have known we would never believe that. This gives you a little bit of the human dynamic of what is going on. Okay, what is the Defense Department official policy? By the way, when I read these sentences, I think you should imagine that you're a Chinese general or admiral or intelligence chief in Beijing, and you are being handed this speech, which is really one of six that have taken place. Basically, you have to imagine, ladies and gentlemen, we intend to play a positive, pivotal, stabilizing role in Asia. That is what the rebalance is all about. It has nothing to do with China. To those who ask whether we'll be able to deliver on our commitments to the new rebalance, the text here uses the word gonna, G-O-N-N-A. It's repeatedly, frequently. I'm gonna give you five reasons why we'll be able to do so. By the way, I'm sticking to the text. That's why I'm going to say gonna. By the way, the speaker is a good friend of mine. His name is Ash Carter. He has a PhD in nuclear physics, and he taught at Harvard University for more than 20 years. However, he prefers to use gonna. It has a certain down-home American sound to it. I'm going to give you the five reasons why we will be able to do so, to carry out the rebalance. Number one, increased military capacity. Naval assets will be released from Afghanistan and the Middle East, including surface ships, amphibious ships, and eventually aircraft carriers, to move to Asia. The Air Force will send unmanned systems and intelligence assets, as well as bomber forces, cyber forces, and space forces, all to be deployed to the Asia-Pacific region. And the Army and the Marine Corps, equipment previously committed to Iraq, will be available for new missions. Number two, so you're the Chinese general. You're being told all the stuff we use in the Middle East is coming to your territory. Number two, we are investing in new capabilities, especially relevant to the Asia-Pacific region. In the Navy, we're going to build new Virginia-class submarines and Virginia payload modules, which will allow our attack submarines to carry torpedo-sized weapons and over 60 cruise missiles each. We are investing in anti-submarine warfare capabilities, maritime patrol aircraft like the P-8A, the Broad Area Maritime Sensor Program, which is a marinized version of the Global Hawk, and the Air Force is investing in a very new stealthy bomber. We are investing in things like cyberspace and electronic warfare, unmanned aerial vehicles, the long-range strike family of systems. All, this is great. All of which are so important to the Asia-Pacific region. Number three. By 2020, we will have shifted 60% of our naval forces to the Pacific. We will begin to rotate B-1 bombers to the region. We've already deployed F-22s to Japan. We will deploy the new F-35 Joint Strike Fighter to the region. Said differently, this is quite important, we are sending our newest military assets to the Asia-Pacific region first. If you're a Chinese general, I think chills are going up and down your spine at this point. Number four, we are working closely with our allies and partners. State Department has the lead on diplomacy. A key objective of our rebalance is a healthy, transparent U.S.-China defense relationship. We're going to work closely with them to create, to build an enduring foundation for U.S.-China military relations. Secretary Panetta invited the Chinese to participate in the annual Rim of the Pacific exercise, which is our largest multilateral maritime exercise. We have 172 exercises in the Asian region with 24 countries. Looking forward to expanding that further. And then the final, and Susan, you recall when we were in Beijing in June, the Chinese were complaining to us. You didn't invite us to your big exercise. So we ran back and conveyed this complaint. And only 2 months later, official invitation to the Chinese. You'll never guess what they said about this wonderful opportunity to operate with our Navy and many other navies, in fact, all the other navies of Asia. They said no. I'm setting you up for the second half of my presentation, which is about Chinese perceptions of all this. The final point in the speech, he says, fifth and last. And to appreciate what I'm about to read to you, you have to understand Chinese views of India. Chinese, in my personal opinion, think of India as a challenge. It's an upstart. They're basically an impediment or a block to China being the leader of all of Asia. And the Indians desperately want a UN Security Council permanent seat. The Chinese totally oppose this. Say India is not qualified. They used to say India has no nuclear weapons. That's why they're not qualified. Now they're looking for new reasons why India is not qualified. But there's a big problem with China's perceptions of India as a threat. So what is the last point about the rebalance? We are deepening our security cooperation, technology sharing, and defense trade with India, another state so important to our rebalance. In fact, I gotta do this right. The only limit to our cooperation with India should be our independent strategic decisions, not bureaucratic obstacles, unquote. Get the drift? There's no limit to our strategic cooperation with India as long as both of us agree to it. You're the Chinese general. Okay, The rest of the speech is also brilliantly done, and I refer you to the website. This was a speech at the Wilson Center back in October. Now, let's put on our hats as professors of philosophy and history and perceptions or intelligence analysts who are trying to understand the Chinese reaction to this. The first thing you have to know about China is a wonderful word that philosophers use, American philosophers and European philosophers use. Incommensurability. If someone asked you, did you go to that talk today? I couldn't make it. What happened? Oh, this funny guy came in from Washington. He used a big word, incommensurability. This is a fundamental debate about China. Western philosophers, led first by a professor in Paris, the University of Paris, named François Julien, who's written the best books in the world, in my opinion, on China and how China thinks. He's written 14 books. The first seven are now translated by MIT Press into English. His thesis is incommensurability. Since ancient Greek times, China's view of what the world is, how it works, what religion is, the nature of human beings, how physics works, the nature of mathematics, the Chinese have a different path that they're on. So they think very differently than Westerners. That's his thesis. He's been joined by a number of professors in the United States. Roger Ames, University of Honolulu, is the leader. He's done seven books on this topic. There's a University of Pennsylvania professor named Victor Mayer, done himself several books. All of these professors have had to retranslate the Chinese classics. They're saying the original first few generations that understood China from 1600 on, beginning with the Jesuits in China, they mistranslated and in some sense they dumbed down differences in Chinese concepts and the Chinese characters that were used to put them into Portuguese or Latin or English. And some scholars got into the Vatican's secret library, found the original Jesuit records from 1595 to 1600. Matteo Ricci was the man's name, that interpreted what is Chinese religion all about. And there was something called the Rites Controversy, R-I-T-E-S, Rites, which is an issue today in our relationship with China. In the Rites Controversy, the Jesuits said, if a person wants to become a Christian, says, I accept Jesus, I accept the role of the Holy Father in Rome, that's enough. If he wants to go home, light incense, and put some food and wine out to a small shrine in his home to make sure his ancestors are happy, that is not a contradiction with Christianity. And Rome, for the first 100 years, said, okay, that's fine. On the assurance that this is just some sort of, you know, birthday party kind of thing with the ancestors and the wine. And then another group overturned all that. The Pope issued a papal bull, said no. Anybody who wants to be a Christian has to stop ancestor worship. Because if you believe your ancestor is up there and can do things, and you're propitiating him or worshiping him, big word in some religions, and certainly in the Catholic religion, you're not accepting God and Jesus. You're worshiping your ancestors. You can't do that and be a good Christian. So the problem was the way the Jesuits interpreted some key characters, the idea of God, the idea of religion, the idea of worship. And down to this present day, when I was selected to be the interpreter for Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, when China's president came over to the Pentagon. We had an honor greeting. We went upstairs. We had about an hour. And Secretary Rumsfeld had quite a few things to say. And then the Chinese president had a lot of things to say. And there's a burden on interpreters of choosing the exact equivalence of what each side is trying to say. But actually, all interpreters in the Chinese language know this is not possible. There are many words that don't exist in one language or in the other. There are proverbs. Some proverbs we all know. Kill two birds with one stone. That's actually a Chinese proverb too. That's easy. But when you start saying kill a chicken to scare the monkeys, or don't climb trees seeking ants, these are common Chinese proverbs. It's hard to find an exact equivalent. And Secretary Rumsfeld has a personal interest, he reveals this in his memoirs, in Chinese proverbs. He has some favorite Chinese proverbs. And his idea was to use them that day without advance clearance from the president or Colin Powell, our Secretary of State. Now, that's as far as I can go without a visit from the FBI agents. Because you'll never guess what happened to the long memo of the meeting. It's not just me and Rumsfeld and President Hu. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is there. There's eight people are there. So the memo is written up, and somebody takes out a stamp, top secret, which actually is probably a very good idea. So that story will have to wait. But in interpreting between the two societies, we have things like this speech and the others saying this is not about China. We're just rebalancing because of the rise of Asia, great economies, great trade. In Chinese history, leaders rise and fall, battles are won, dynasties are created, hegemons are destroyed, pulled down and destroyed, usually by one key technique. This is in my new book coming out on how China sees its own history. The technique, translated roughly, is deception. The better deceiver wins. One of the Chinese set of proverbs has to do with don't let the old emperor, the old hegemon, know what you're up to until it's too late for him. And there's a wonderful Chinese proverb that captures this. Besides incommensurability, you can say, yeah, we had this weird lunch speaker, and he said something about asking the weight of the cauldron, asking the weight of a 3-ton cauldron. In Chinese, it's one ding. One is ask, ding. The cauldron is the name for a huge cauldron I'll tell you about in a minute. There are 9 of them, owned by the emperor. Zhong jing, heavy light, or jing zhong, heavy light, light heavy, which means in Chinese, weight, because the Chinese concept is to take two opposite polarities, put them together in the same word, and it means the thing that the two polarities oppose, you might say. We don't do that in our language. We have a word like weight. We don't say light heavy. To ask about the light heavy of the cauldron, this is a crucial proverb. It means you have a secret motivation to take over the empire or the world because you're asking about what only the emperor can have. Emperors have 9 cauldrons out in front of the palace. In the beginning, 1000 BC, each of the 9 states had to send a cauldron to the emperor to acknowledge that he was the emperor. Curiosity about what it's like to be emperor in one key moment in Chinese history reveals to the old emperor, aha. And this kingdom, by the way, the price that its leader paid for asking the weight of the cauldrons was to have his kingdom wiped out. Now, we, as good Americans, we'd all say, what, just for asking the weight of a cauldron? Yeah. Well, yes, because deception is so important in the rise and fall of dynasties or in the victory and defeat in war, that you must always be on the lookout for deception by your opponent. So probably the most important sentence in these various speeches that have made over the last 2 years is this rebalancing, this pivot, is not about China. So we now have several books, quite a few magazine articles coming out of China, authoritative specialists in the military, in the national security field, saying which is sort of a shock to America. So you got to prepare yourself. Americans all know, at least in diplomacy and being nice to the world, President Obama, did better than President George W. Bush. Now, I'm a Republican, but I acknowledge President Obama is far more popular overseas than President Bush. But when the Chinese hear about the pivot and the rebalance, they began to write in their public journals, in terms of China policy, Obama is worse than Bush. Then they followed each of the steps, the Marines being rebalanced to Australia, the deployment of carriers, the deployment of advanced American air power, the buildup on Guam. Each time we do something like this, it produces headlines in China along the lines of Americans continue encircling China. And this fits into a larger movement that's been going on for 20 years in China. This is, I guess, my last point. After the Tiananmen, what we call massacre, they say unfortunate incident, the Chinese did a reevaluation because the world in general slapped sanctions on China. This is very bad. You can't just gun down 700 students downtown Beijing and laugh it off or say that they were foreign inspired or they shouldn't have been there. When the sanctions were slapped on, the Western countries and Japan, I believe, all thought China would understand this. This is just a slap in the, kind of like a slap. You did a bad thing, you need to go straight. Don't kill any more students downtown in Beijing. That's not how they took it. In fact, a big fork in the road was taken by the Chinese in a very popular way to them. The West and Japan are out to get us, and they're using these sanctions not because of killing a few students. I mean, we have a billion people. What is 700 dead students? Besides, they shouldn't have been there. They're giving them more than a month to disperse. No, this is the revelation of a deceptive plot that the West, led by the Americans, does not want China to rise. This is our first big warning. So they started a program called the National Humiliation Program. Deng Xiaoping himself said, our young people don't understand the nature of the world outside and what it's going to come and do to stop China's rise. So a program began, which is now in its 20th year, National Humiliation Day. Textbooks about humiliation imposed on China, what they call red tourism sites, where no foreigners are taken. They would misunderstand. But the sites for tourism are places where China suffered humiliation. It used to be the British and the Japanese were the worst humiliators since 1840. But there's been a slight shift in the textbooks, the tourist sites, and so forth. You'll never guess who humiliated China the most since 1840. Yes, us. So, Susan and I, in June, or a month or two later, we knew about one of the most famous national humiliation sites, and we asked if we could go see it. At first, they said, no, you wouldn't want to see that. And what site? I said, well, it's in Macau. No, we don't have any. I said, yes, it's in a Taoist temple. It's in an old Taoist temple down the street from the Steve Wynn Casino and the Sheldon Adelson Casino. They each cost several billion dollars. Oh, that Taoist temple. So he went to it. Sure enough, it's a big monument. And they bring school children through the site every weekday. People fly in from all over China to come to this site. What is it? It's a big stone table. This is the table where the US and China signed their first treaty in 1840. Called the Treaty of Wangxia. It's named after the temple. Well, why is this a national humiliation? Because you Americans forced opium on us and ran the opium war. The British were, in some sense, conniving with you or even working for you. to bring about one of China's greatest disgraces, which is true, the forced opium campaign that China wanted to stop. Turns out we're in lots of these national humiliation stories, we the Americans. So if my worst case analysis is right, a whole new generation of Chinese are being told unfortunate things about the United States and the world outside. And it means, if you want to be optimistic and constructive, we have a major problem in front of us to build trust and try to undo this. But first, we have to find a tactful way to draw to the Chinese leaders' attention. For the last 20 years, you've been saying these unfortunate things about us. We wish you would stop. We'd like to have a historians commission meet, you know, compare our version of the last 150 years, where we Americans, with archival documents to back it up, we think we built hospitals in China. We set up your best colleges that are still there today. We think we had an aid program. We think President Truman got in deep trouble with the Republican right for not helping Chiang Kai-shek win against you guys. So back home, the Democratic Party was attacked for 20 years for losing China. You can't have it both ways. So we would have this list, and there are plenty more in the military area, in the economic area, where we think the Chinese are telling an untrue story to the next generation and making them memorize it, making them repeat it back, and saying, if you don't believe all this, you can't be a successful person in China. That's the minimum we would have to do to have a kind of trust-building campaign. But back to incommensurability. The professors I quoted earlier are saying it won't work. It would take an almost infinite level of resources and an infinite amount of time to change Chinese perceptions of what the outside world is trying to do to them. So don't try. But so far in Washington, the optimists have the day, and there's a desire to hedge against China's rise and do these kinds of things that are in the rebalancing, but also at the same time try to build trust and reduce misperceptions. So I don't know if that's enough for you to have some questions you want to ask, or you just want to go straight to your lunch. But I think I'm safe from the FBI.
What are the potentials for Russian-Chinese cooperation or conflict?
Very important question. The rebalancing strategy of President Obama actually comes at the end of almost 200 years of America trying various strategies toward Asia. There's a consistency. There's a new book coming out by a friend of mine. He's the first guy. He worked for President Bush, but he's also a professor in Georgetown. He's the first guy to do the history. What do our archives show from Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin on our Asia strategy was? And he tries to show from a lot of quite brilliant archival detective work, he tries to show the American view of Asia has been to balance off the various powers, not let any one power become so powerful that it could hurt American trade or American interests in Asia. And at various times, he says, we've tried to align ourselves with almost every single power. We also have tried to oppose. It's like going to a dance where there's several partners of the opposite sex, and you dance with them all, or you have a fight with them all. That's kind of a thumbnail history of the last 200 years. Right now, my personal opinion is we need Russia to help us with China. We cannot afford to alienate both Moscow and Beijing at the same time. There are some Russians who agree with this and are worried about China. There are others who say the opposite. The interesting question is where Vladimir Putin stands, because President Putin has said it both ways. He sometimes talks about China and we have to work together. Other times he says the opposite. But I think it's an opportunity. Our chances to cooperate with the Russians even more, I think, is an opportunity. So I'm in that school of thought.
Why is China hoarding gold?
Why is China hoarding gold? Oh my. Actually, India is worse. The whole issue of, this raises the whole issue of resources. One of the areas for that optimists believe is for cooperation with China is resources, not just gold, but sort of everything. And the Chinese don't see it that way. They see physical possession of resources, including gold, but also ownership of oil fields, any kind of resource you could imagine that's important to economic growth. They would like to, as much as they can, to control or to invest in or to own that resource. Which I think goes back to incommensurability and the role of deception. And they've explained to us, explained to Susan and me, that in a crisis, you know, you great powers in the West, when there's a crisis or a war, you know what you always do? I say, no, I really, could you refresh my memory? They say, you always try to choke off the resources. That's how you beat Japan in World War II. You had a lot of submarines. You choked off Japan's oil and metal supply. And they came to their knees. The Germans wanted to do this against England. There's a sort of a long set of Chinese books about how great powers in the West win wars. And it's to choke off resources. So how can you blame us Chinese for trying to take care of our resource problems in case of a crisis someday with you guys in the West? We will need these things.
Will China continue to back the new regime in North Korea? What future in China and Korea?
One of the most interesting comments ever to come out of the Chinese about North Korea. You would think they'd be allies. It's the one military ally China has. It's a treaty. They did help them, if you want to phrase it that way, in 1950. They withdrew their troops in 58, went home. When Secretary of State Albright, in 2000, went to North Korea, you would think the Chinese would say, oh, isn't that wonderful? The Americans are extending the hand of friendship to our military ally, North Korea. That's what I would have said. No. We began to hear from the Chinese, the North Koreans and China have had a border dispute for 1,000 years. We never trusted them. They dragged us into the Korean War. And now they want to unify Korea and have American military forces come inside North Korea and move up closer to China, because the Americans want to get their forces close to China. Now, when these reports, when these conversations I had in Beijing came in, it's close to unbelievable. There was no American known to me who wanted to put U.S. military forces into North Korea after reunification. But for the past decade, I'm hearing this over and over. When are you Americans going to make your rapprochement with North Korea and the young 27-year-old? We know he likes pop music. We know he goes on the internet. You know, there's this lookout for to do to us. One Chinese friend told me, you want to do to us in North Korea what you did to us in Burma. And you have to take a second and pause. What? But then you have to know the Chinese version of Burma. Our version is President Obama, Secretary Clinton reached out the hand of friendship to try to help Aung San Suu Kyi, try to talk the regime into loosening up on human rights. They were willing to do so when Kurt Campbell went there. So we opened Burma. That's our view. We want to have an enlightened Burma. No, Chinese view, Burma was ours. It's in our sphere of influence. All the trade investment was between us and Burma. There's only two countries that Burma wouldn't work with, India and America. Now you Americans and you and the Indians have taken Burma away from us. Exact quote from a Chinese visitor one time. Why? Because if you see the world as a geopolitical chessboard in which countries are pawns or their Wei Qi chips, if you read Henry Kissinger's brilliant new book on China, it's just a masterpiece. Kissinger spends his whole first chapter on the game of Wei Qi. So Burma would be a Wei Qi chip, or an area that would be surrounded. That's a very difficult worldview to deal with. That's how they see North Korea, something the Americans are after.
How big a risk is it that Japanese-Chinese East China Sea dispute will bring us into violence?
Ooh. Nobody knows the answer to that. Optimists poo-poo the whole thing. Oh, this is just, you know, it's just the Chinese Coast Guard and the Japanese Coast Guard, and nobody lives on these islands. There's nothing to it. The other side is more sober. It's my side. We say, look, the Japanese have scrambled 160 jet fighters to go down there when the Chinese approach these islands. This is serious. The Japanese are very pacifistic recently. They don't scramble jet fighters really for any reason that isn't serious. The Chinese side is not backing down. China's president made a speech last week about this. So it's not, you know, light your hair on fire if you have any hair. It's a problem that so far President Obama's approach has been to try to appeal to both sides for calm and restraint.
Why are we doing things that entice the Chinese to do what we don't want them to do?
Because we're Americans.
I'll leave it at that.
No, I've written an article. Let me advertise an article I've written that had to go through a security review and they took something out, which really made me very bitter. But the article appears in the current issue of this very prestigious journal that's published in London. It's called Survival. It's published by the British, probably is the leading think tank in the world. It's called the IISS, International Institute for Strategic Studies. Henry Kissinger's on the board, and it was created by the British to stop nuclear war. Survival means, you know, don't have nuclear war. In this article, which is called The 16 Fears, The 16 Fears, - Chinese Strategic Psychology. I try to go into some of these issues with quotations from Chinese military and civilian officials. In the article, I don't use the word incommensurability because the British editor said, no one knows what that is.
Ray rebalancing. Has the U.S. tried this before? An example, how did it work?
Yes. If the questioner means the last 200 years, I mean, yes, we've tried it before. We've tried to rebalance. If you go back to old American war plans, which I guess shows you what I do in my spare time or what the government pays me to do, if you go back to our old war plans, we first started war planning after the Civil War, because we were kind of surprised by various events. For a long time, in the early 1800s, actually, the main enemy was Britain. And by the 1890s, 1905 period, the American military war plans were about the British using Jamaica and the Caribbean and bases in South America to separate us from South America. And so the plans talk about which U.S. forces will go from where to sort of stop this British plot and how we will stop British ships from coming through. It was a rebalance towards South America to protect ourselves from the British. And I think it was each war plan for a long time had a color. I think the one for Britain was black, war plan black. And our government tried to keep it classified for a long time because it might upset the British to find out. Yeah. And my wife is born in England. But eventually it was released along with many other plans. And a lot of scholars have written interesting books about America's propensity to plan for the wrong war. And the best quotation on this I have ever heard was about 2 years ago. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, a friend of mine, I think it was off, he claims is off the cuff. Somebody asked him, it had to do with the office I work in, that has to do with, our office has to do with anticipating future wars. Somebody asked Secretary Gates a question that was basically, how well have we done anticipating wars before they break out? And Secretary Gates said, we have a perfect record. We've never gotten a single war right.
Is the U.S. goading Japan into confrontation with China?
No, no. President Obama's policy is very upsetting to the Japanese. We have not backed them. We have not said Japan is our treaty ally, China is not. Or you could even say China is communist, Japan is free. No, we've avoided all of that rhetoric. It's the opposite. And this is a debate in Asia. What are the Americans doing? Here's their ally being kind of bullied, if you will, by the Chinese, and the Americans are taking the attitude of, why don't you two guys work this out responsibly and peaceably?
In your opinion, what would work to change perception?
Well, I mentioned the infinite number of resources and the infinite amount of time. But I would say the first thing, and I'm trying to do this myself, the first thing is to identify the most dangerous Chinese misperceptions of us. We need an inventory. We need to understand what is it that they think about us. We can't fix everything. If they think we have poor taste because we eat hamburgers instead of twice cooked pork, that we can't fix that. It's probably true. But if they think our Guam buildup is to dismember China into seven countries, which is an article that appeared, we can try to work on that. No, here's what the Guam buildup is about. So identifying the most dangerous misperceptions that are held by the Chinese, ideally at the top level, would be the first part of the first answer to that question. And then second, we have to think about techniques that involve confidence building or reducing misperceptions and how this would work. In our relationship with the Chinese military, that I've been involved with since 1972, actually. There are ways that military officers can reassure each other, even when they lack trust. They're so-called confidence-building measures. We do none of these now with China. The Russians have been doing it for quite some time. So there's an area of work about confidence-building measures once we've identified the most dangerous misperceptions.
I think we'll wind up with this question, and maybe you've touched on it. What most drives China's relationship with the U.S.? Is it historical? Is it distrust? Is their belief in their own superiority balanced by what drives the U.S. relationship with China? Is it our belief in our own superiority? Is it our distrust, or is it our misunderstanding?
I would say what drives their relationship with us is the desire to become a great power, to restore China's greatness. They got onto this in 1978. They said if any of you visit China again, you could ask your tour guide, how did you like the 50s when you were aping and imitating the Soviet model, the Soviet Union? And all the tour guide, we lost 10 years. Soviets didn't understand economics. They didn't know how to become a great power. Lost 10 years. How'd you like the 60s? Cultural revolution, smashing all your cultural temples and artifacts. No, that was a mistake too. How'd you like Deng Xiaoping and the idea of exporting to America, bringing in American technology, and sending 100,000 students to American universities? Oh, working. Big success. So they see us as the key to China's return to its greatness. But there's a catch. We're also the greatest obstacle, because they think Americans would not be so stupid as to allow China to surpass the United States. They flatter us.
Thank you. Now, before you leave... We offer this historical memento for you.
You have to come up. Equality, equality.
This is our official coffee mug.
Ah.
That when you go into the Pentagon, I hope they let you through with it.
Is it bugged?
No, it's not. Thank you very much.